Probably I should start the evening by talking about the next retreat, since I know someone will ask me about it. And the title is the Striking Power of God?
The Power of God is Striking.
The Power of God is Striking. Even better. Because it will be striking. If it hasn't struck you yet, it will. And to prepare for that strike of divine lightning, and to encourage it, in fact, and be ready for its effect upon you, a paradigm shift is necessary, and an openness of the heart to receive that amount of energy without being killed by it, literally, and as well as being shattered in a psychological sense. We're coming to the end of this divine drama. The final scenes of the drama are about to be played. And in the final scenes of every classical drama, of course, appears the Deus Ex Machina, and out of the machine of the body of those who have dedicated themselves to become channels of Deus, of the supreme intelligence, that power will strike with in infinite intensity and suddenness. But it will be a suddenness that comes after much gradual preparation. And that's the pattern of everything. The society is collapsing very gradually, but then there will be a sudden, total crumbling. One day, without any notice, the dollar will be worthless, and there will be war, a surprise attack without notice, and food shortages and famine that will not have been prepared for by most because the media will not have given warnings, and there will be disinformation, etc., etc. So everything is moving very gradually toward the end, but then there will be a sudden shift in which the world changes in a moment from a sustainable ecosystem to a radioactive ruin and a desert of desolation. But at that same moment, and in the lead-up to that moment, the divine presence with the capability of redreaming the dream and of bringing a new heavenly paradise into being will accompany. It's what the Sufis used to talk about as the garden and the flames being simultaneously present. And so we must be in that Edenic consciousness that can recreate the garden even in the midst of the flames and not be touched by the flames because we have become the fire and we have become the tree of life, the eternal life from which the garden's fruits can flower. And so the more of us, the more of all of the beings in the world who choose to let go of egoic obsession and false identification and return to our true nature, the more we'll be struck by that lightning of God's presence and the ultimate manifestation of all of the prophecies of the many of the world's spiritual traditions will be fulfilled. But fulfilled in ways that are uncanny and that could not have been predicted by those with a conventional frame of reference, even if they are believers in various scriptures, because none of that can be taken literally, but the intelligence of God will manifest what is being implied and pointed to by those words that have endured through time and have become the human heritage to prepare us all for the culmination of the drama and to achieve the heroic role of one who is not only liberated into the nirvanic beauty and bliss that is untouched by suffering, but with the power of transmitting that divine energy of deathlessness and of peace and healing to all the beings who may still be contained within the darkness of the ego shadow and not yet have realized the presence of the light within and without. And so the transformation will be sudden, and those who are divinized will spread that coherent vibrational frequency throughout the morphogenic field of the planet, and it will have a profound effect and bring about universal salvation. No soul will be left behind, whether they are still embodied or they have become disembodied as a result of events that have occurred on the earth plane, but all will be returned to that supreme abode and protected by the presence of God from any suffering. And all the hell realms will be emptied, and all will be again in the unified oceanic field of the blissful light of God until the new world manifests for those who have prepared to sustain it. So that's what the retreat is about in a nutshell, that preparation that is required to call forth, to invoke the Vajra, the essence of that lightning, and to be able to run it through the system as a current of energy that can be applied to the service of God. So rather than having a shattering effect, it will have a transmuting effect upon not just the body, but upon the entire energy field. And it will create echoes and vibrational waves throughout the field and have many divine consequences that will be astonishing when they appear and will be filled with the miraculous and surprising nature of the final unfoldment as the play comes to its denouement. So the great playwright is about to show that final scene in which he lets out all the stops and all of the latent powers that had been forgotten and that had atrophied within us are suddenly brought to the fullness of life again. And we not only realize who we are, but that realization becomes actualized as divinization. And the whole world is perceived by those who have been struck by that lightning of divine presence as God, as the One Self. There is nothing other than that. all of this will be seen by the eye of non-duality in its true nature. And the illusion of time and space and difference and multiplicity will all disappear. And the real will be fully manifest. So may you be hit by that lightning which opens the third eye and become one who is able to see, and through that eye, the powers of divine sight manifest the projection of the creative intelligence of God that brings a new world into being. So I hope that is sufficient understanding of what our retreat and our preparation must be. And to do that, we must complete the work of becoming egoless and having our minds and hearts filled only with the joyous presence of God. And we must be without a trace of fear or anger or any of the other vices of the ego that is based in a paranoid paradigm of unreality rather than the vision of the real that is forever beautiful, true, and good. So, without further ado, let's return to the sweet sorrows of the great Sheikh Attar, who is preparing us for this event. All of these poems are preparation for the internal transformation that must happen quickly now to be ready for the lightning storm of the divine approach that is upon us. I don't remember where I left off exactly, but I'll read a few from the middle of the book and then hopefully leave time for your comments, because how many of you have read the book by now, or most of it? Right? Yeah, a few? Some. Okay, not that many, apparently. But I think you will find these to be very useful for your meditations, because they are so short, to the point, and often very touching of the heart and of the, perhaps, of the issues that are still to be faced and to be resolved. I'll start with number 24 on page 15. I saw my existence, and it was a shadow, cast aground by that sun that is my beloved. I reached to catch the hem of his robe, and I saw his hand in my sleeve. Whoever realizes the mystery in this story is greatly fortunate and may taste victory. So, look at all the information. Your existence, if you believe you're a bodily being, is a shadow. It's the shadow. The ego mind is the shadow of your real self. It's not who you are. And if you allow your shadow to run your life, it's going to take you into deeper darkness, not to the beloved. And yet, the beloved, the sun, the divine, the supreme sun, is shining. And if only you realize you are not the body and you become the transparent consciousness that is vibrating in the same frequency of that divine energy of love and light, then there will be no shadow cast. And then you will realize that it's God's hand in your sleeve. It's not the hand of a shadow figure. And this is the realization of the victory, the divinization of consciousness that makes one an avatar. So look how much is in that tiny poem, that if you understand just those words, you are liberated. You don't need to read any other material. And the next one, when there is one who is all there is, how can this thought called me exist? So they're even shorter, you know. You can't get to a much shorter haiku that goes right to the core understanding. So let's see. I could read them all, but I'm not going to do that. But let's go to number 35 on the next page. A lunatic who made his home in a cemetery witnessed final prayers for one corpse too many. Turning to the crowds, he declared in his genuine wit, "Why not say a farewell prayer for this entire world and all in it and get it over with?" Well, that story is about to play out. But it's very interesting that he's talking about lunatics living in a cemetery because, of course, in India, many sadhus, the Aghoris in particular, but many of the tantrics in the Middle Ages, the Chud practitioners, would go to cemeteries to do their ritual meditations, and some would live there and in fact, take on the job of burning the corpses. But it's that detachment from the illusion of biological life that is necessary for us to know the taste of eternal life and have no compunctions about feeling it's some disaster or catastrophe for the Kali Yuga world to end, because all it ends is many sorrows that are not so sweet. Let's go to number 44 on page 18. To be content is to see blessings in all things and within them to behold the one who gives all blessings. So that has to be our mode of perception. It has to be real. It has to be authentic. We take a vow of contentment, of santosha, but we can only fulfill that vow if we see blessings in everything that occurs and in everyone who we see and in every object, every event, and within them behold the presence of God, who is the giver of all blessings. To see and realize there is only God. There is no other. Even if some are seeing only the shadow, but once the eye is open, one sees only the light. Let's go to the next page and number 52. You were nothing once and will soon again be nothing. Why not be nothing now as well? What is a human? A drop separated from the sea. Sorrows won't find it if it drowns and loses itself in the ocean. So that's the question, that's our assignment, to be nothing, to be a drop that returns to the sea and disappears within it and becomes the ocean. And the next one, when one dies, one of two things happens. If he arrive filthy, he is scrubbed. And if he arrive pure, he is clothed in peace. So to be scrubbed means you're diverted to a bardo state to have a visit with some wrathful deities and get the vulgar sanskaras cleaned out. But all of it will be recognized as a blessing that will then enable one to be clothed in peace and eternal love. Let's see. Let's go to number 63 on page 21. The reason you've been told that love for one's place of origin is a sign of faith is that in your place of origin, within your soul, resides your beloved. You are your own beloved. Come back to yourself. Do not search the world over to return within to your origin. So it's complete Advaita. God, Allah, is the self, not another. It's yourself you're missing because you're living in your shadow. Your place of origin is not somewhere in the world, and it's not with some biological group of beings. Your origin is in the heart. And there alone you will find what you're looking for and realize you are the beloved. Now the next one. Let your soul learn about the inner meaning and become a royal hawk worthy of the king's arm. You know how hawks take off from the arm of the falconer? So one day when it hears the call of his special drum, it will take to its wings and fly home. So this is the preparation that I'm talking about for the end. You must be able to hear when God calls you. You must be able to fly, and you must know which direction to fly to, and you must recognize the king and be worthy of landing on God's arm. And it is that royalty and that capacity to fly that comes from the lightness of having let go of all the burdens of attachment to the anything or anyone in the phenomenal plane that enables one to fulfill that highest destiny. And then the next one. If here you do not refine your vision, you will die blind and rise blind hereafter. So this is a very important one, because being in Kali Yuga, when we are more or less all born into the shadow realm, because we are identified by the parents as the shadow, not as the self. We are not seen for who we are. We identify with that shadow and we become blind. We cannot see the light. And if you do not erase that shadow, if you do not break through and realize you are the light now, then you will vibrate at that level of false consciousness and have to come back in another life in order to complete that breakthrough. So this is the moment to do it, so that you graduate and become divine again. That's our true nature. And not have to cope with a life in which you are clueless as to who you are and you are ruled by the shadow rather than the real self. This is the moment, while alive in the body, that one has to attain the vision of God consciousness. O slumbering one, should you be wise? To your desires and wants you'd shut your eyes, for it's your greed that brings your demise. Wayfarers we are, and in the eyes of a wayfarer, nothing in this flea market should deserve a second glance. Trust the giver in steadfast patience. For if he does not withhold from those who never remember, why would he withhold from those who only in him put their trust? So have faith that if you do go through a transfiguration of your values, if you let go of all your ego holds dear, and give all to God in this life, trust you will receive the full reward and it will be worth that sacrifice. And the sacrifice itself is only a letting go of your suffering. But you must wake up from that slumber now. To pray after you have descended to this mud pit in shame is to seek your soul's way to its origin. So that's what prayer really is, right? Getting out of the mud pit. And you have to stop wanting to be a mud wrestler if you're going to do that. But that the only way to the soul's salvation is to stop believing that you're made of mud and that you come to recognize you are a being of light. Well, let's see. To live is to dare death so as to break out of existence and to arrive at life. That was number 70. Seventy-one's an interesting story. The great Sheikh of Mena once was experiencing a contraction of the heart. Step outside, he said to his disciple, and bring in the first man you come across. The attendant returned with an old man in trail. Speak to me of your life and times. Mayhap it will make my heart expand, said Sheikh Abu Sa'id. May you be blessed, said the man. Yesterday morn, life gave me a son, whom in my jubilation I named Javed Anzad, meaning forever alive, in our Zoroastrian tongue. Today I performed his funeral, for last night he died. And may the Sheikh live long. And they both shed a few tears. And so, if your heart is contracted, if you feel any selfishness or greed or egocentricity or narcissism or even sarcasm or cynicism, it means your heart has contracted. And if you do that, the medicine is to feel compassion for those who suffer and allow yourself to feel that suffering as if it were your own. And then let your heart soften and open and again be able to offer blessings of deep understanding and of inner peace. A perfect one said, "A wise one is not one who lives happily, but one who dies with a happy heart, free from that which may hold him back." So a perfect one, who's a perfect one? It's a Buddha. Although they have another word in Arabic for that, the insan, but it's the same concept. And the perfect one transcends the illusion of the duality of life and death. So it's no longer about living happily. But one's ego has already died, and with a happy heart, there is nothing left that would hold one back or cause one to return to have another life in Kali Yuga, either in this Kali Yuga or the next. And there is no obstacle and no restraint from dissolving into the fullness of the infinite ocean of consciousness and realizing the self as that. Some of these, of course, are repetitive because they're all dealing with the same issue, the same point, but always with a slightly different angle. Though a human, this is 73, though a human here seems a handful of dirt, no dirt ever touches the sun within. One who doesn't behold that sun dies a blind bat. A life not offered to one's beloved is its own punishment. Well, I don't know that that needs any comment. Let's move forward so we don't run out of time and we can get to some other angles. 76, that which you have never lost and know nothing about, but have always been looking for, if someone were to ask you what it is, what would your answer be? Sit in solitude and stop this prattle in your mind, so you may perchance ponder what your true desire is. So rarely do people leave the surface of the ego mind to go into the heart to find out, what is your life about? What do you really want? What will fulfill you? It's not what the ego thinks it wants. But you have to stop all the prattle and chatter of the mind in order to get there. All right, let's go to number 79. That one's pretty strong. Tell me, how does one have to rattle your prison chains? Having crept into your own trap, how long will you worship your own delusion? How many are worshiping your delusion still? No, none of you are, I'm sure. But that's what the ego is. It's a delusion, a self-fabricated delusion that one is in love with because it's one's creation. And yet, it's your shadow. And that delusion keeps you from knowing who is the real creator. So, we crept into our own trap. We can't blame anyone else. We chose our parents that we were born to. We weren't victims. But if we're going to turn the trap into freedom, we have to not worship the delusion, but learn that it is a delusion, and then learn How do you heal others from their delusions? Because we are here to be healers, not to be patients in a madhouse. Someone asked a seafarer to tell him of the wonders of the sea. The greatest wonder of all, said the sailor, is that in this vastness full of peril, any ship ever makes it ashore. And very few do. Very few souls make it to the other shore of non-duality and God consciousness and eternal life and graduation from this level of the school. Very few. Many shipwrecks. Many people are walking, living shipwrecks. We don't want to be among those, but we want to be able to repair those ships and make them seaworthy. 82. The alchemy practiced by the true ones is to let your entire being become your heart, and then fill it with this longing and pain, the pain of wanting the one you can't explain. Since neither on earth nor in heavens it can be found, be still and contemplate your heart. What else is there to speak about? So it's interesting that the alchemy has to be the attainment of becoming all heart, all love. And that means without suffering. It's the sweetness. But then we have to pour the sorrow into the sweetness in order to become bodhisattvas and have compassion and understanding of the non-duality of duality and non-duality. We have to live in samsara with all of its samsaros, and we have to turn it into nirvana. But we have to feel the sum of those sorrows in order to have the totality that brings the bliss of realization. To be truly smart, 83, to be truly smart is to outsmart your own clever mind. And that's the biggest challenge perhaps anyone can face. 90. David the prophet asked his creator why humans had been created. We get asked that all the time, right? Online, all the questions that come. Why did God create this world of suffering? How dare he do that? Okay, why? So this hidden treasure, I am, may be discovered, he was told. So, have you discovered the great treasure of the real I am that is your essential nature? Or are you still living in an I am becoming, or I am trying to get there, but not I am? This is interesting, coming from a Muslim. Number 92. To speak words of substance, one needs to have Christ's life-giving breath, and like Mary, give virgin birth. Many people don't know that Islam accepts Jesus as a real, authentic prophet and a manifestation of God. Even though perhaps not the only begotten manifestation, but that which is true and the only one sent for the Christians. And it is Islam is is and was originally a beautiful effort of harmonizing all of the spiritual traditions that Muhammad was aware of, but also even that he wasn't perhaps aware of consciously. And so you will see in the Quran and in the words of the Sufi mystics, Taoism, Buddhism, Hinduism, Christianity, Judaism, the Kabbalah, all of it, alchemy, it's all there. It's a very universal approach, which is why the Sufis say the religion is not to be really called Islam, but love. But there are many Muslims who might not agree with that these days. Ah, okay, 95. I think this one is worth emphasizing. A man came to a wise one and said, "For many years I have looked high and low. Many privations, many pains have I tasted, but no door have I found to enter through." The sheikh said, "You have found that which you have preferred and reached for. For on this path, though we are deeply blind, the giver is as vastly knowing as he is kind. And whatever, in truth, we are reaching for, that and none other are we allowed to find." So if you are not authentically looking for God, you're not going to find God. If you're looking for money, you may find money. It may be worthless once you find it, but you'll find it. If you're looking for a partner, you may find a partner, but it may not give you the true love you were looking for because you haven't found the true beloved. But if you are looking for the beloved and the beloved alone, then that is what you will be destined to find. Number 97, failure is to be blinded by appearances and to make oneself a living corpse. Nowadays we'd say an NPC, but that's the term since they didn't yet have video games. A living corpse, that's what the ego is. Blinded by appearances, takes itself for its body, looks in the mirror and thinks it's seeing itself, when it doesn't realize it's invisible and formless and non-local. Well, he goes on about those, so I won't belabor that point. Let's go to 116 on page 28. "In this world of decay, find that which is not of this world, so you may live after you leave this world. If you live for this, you'll find here death only. Every moment a message comes from the friend. You are a manifestation of the deathless. Why don't you know yourself?" I'm just going to read a few more and then open the floor, and some of you may have ones that you want to share as well. But let me see what else I checked off here that might be worth reading tonight. Okay, 219. "Stop wanting to know secrets." I think that's a very interesting point. Because the ego wants to know all the secrets of God while remaining the ego. Can't be done that way. "Stop wanting to know secrets. Convert to Atar's religion. Die to yourself. Your knowing will lock this gate. Love only comes to those who vanish from themselves." The mind must be emptied of any egoic identity or desire or emotion. There just must be the purity of that light and love shining without any sense of a separate individual being. Then the secrets will be known. 220, nearness. Nearness to God is nearness to come very close to the fire and like a moth to find your joy in the flame. So nearness actually can only be accomplished by going all the way into the flame. If you stay just outside the flame, you'll get singed and burned, but it'll be painful, but you won't have become the flame. So to be near is to be one with God. You can't know God and still be separate. There is no other when there is the true flame of God. Love is to shed yourself, to bow to this lunacy and leaving your mind behind, to reside in this non-being forever, to forget both the beginning and the end, and to dissolve in the secret of the present, its eternal presence, without a past, without a future, without time or space. It's that that can be realized only when the ego is shed. All right, 222. This one really is digging pretty deep. Last night the Beloved appeared and roared. Why are you not moaning, and why is your heart not burning? Have you no shame? Oh, my all, I begged. Release me from myself, please. What me is that? And aren't you ashamed of that self? I was thus silenced. We have to feel that encounter, and be silenced by the face of God facing us with the shame of having clung to the shadow and rejected the real. Ah, 224. I am not for a moment absent from you. The one who is forgetful of you is an alien residing in me. Now, that seems like a shoddy excuse, frankly. You know, shameless. But okay, that's another aspect of the truth. Don't be abducted by an alien. "244. This is a most baffling affair. One of the two has to be true. Either I am not, or there is nothing other than me." No, actually both of the two are true. "258, on page 48. No tears change that which has been ordained. If both worlds vanish at this moment, to the Almighty it is neither a gain nor a loss. So it's important not to wish things were otherwise. Everything is ordained, and it's perfect. And instead of getting angry at your karma, if you'll accept it and recognize it's a gift from God, you will be enlightened and you'll find total fulfillment. And you won't care that this world vanishes, because you will realize that you are God and there's no loss and there's nothing that could be gained. Even if another world, which it will, a heavenly world, appears, that is not something in addition to God. It's only God's way of manifesting. 272 on 50. When you behold your heart and see no darkness, you will see a drop from that ocean that is the Beloved. And then in the center of unity in your soul, you will find the circle of infinity. I think that's very beautiful. Thomas Aquinas would agree, so would many sages. So we have to find the center of unity, which is the zero point, and then the zero turns out to be infinity. Ah, 286 on 52. This is an interesting point. You who reside in the traceless absolute, who do I ask for my way to you? You who reside inside my soul, where do I look for a sign of you? See, this tells you exactly the ego's mistake. It's looking for a way when you are already there. So there is no way. And you're looking for a sign when God is completely signless, completely free of any thoughts. You can't get to God through knowing some thought that will lead you on the way. All of that is the delusion of the ego that is only delaying its own liberation by pretending it's looking for God. The next one, 287. All I want from you, beloved, is for all my wants to vanish. In the realm of surrender, there's no despair, even if the two worlds and all of us in them were to disappear. So you see, these poems are preparing us to vanish and preparing us for the world to vanish. We shouldn't cling to the world. We shouldn't value it. We shouldn't think that if we lose the world, then all is lost. No. The world is only a dream in the mind of God, and nothing can be lost. But because we lost sight of God, we ended up devouring this world, ravishing nature, and turning the world into a hell realm. And it's only when we disappear as egos that that process can be undone and a heavenly world begun. Okay, I'm just going to read maybe one more. I'll stop with 308. Spread the prayer mat of surrender and sit still. In a house made of flesh and bones, one cannot keep a dog. Evict the dog of your ego and be still. That sums it up pretty well. Okay, well, floor is open if anyone wants to talk about how these poems impacted you or how Attar as a whole, if you've read others as well, and whether it has inspired you and brought you closer to that realization of your nothingness and your infinite being. Floor is open. Ah, Jagdish, of course. Do we have a mic? Ah, please.
Thank you. Well, thank you for bringing to our attention number 222, because that was the one that left me numbed in silence.
I'll read it again. What page is it on?
43. Last night that beloved appeared and roared, "Why are you not moaning? And why is your heart not burning? Have you no shame? Oh, my all," I begged, "release me from myself, please. What me is that? And aren't you ashamed of that self?" I was thus silenced, and I read that and said, that's my life. That's
the life of your ego.
That's the life of the ego. And the its deadness, its absence of life. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I felt great shame.
Now, can you turn the shame into love and into joy, right? Because the shame belongs only to the ego. And once you've recognized that it's not you, you're no longer that living corpse. And now you realize you are the one who is shaming you. You are that real self. And that's what you must claim now.
Anji.
Right? See, the problem is the shame also contains pride. And so there's a pride in being that character who has been able to live without love and joy and been a martyr and been dedicated to truth even without happiness and goodness, right? But has been a stalwart ethicist and one who follows the moral law, all of that. So there's a pride also in that character that must be let go of along with the shame. Mm-hmm. And then you're free.
Yeah, it's that satisfaction of superiority, let's say, uh-huh, that says that's good enough. Uh-huh. Yeah. And therefore, there doesn't have to be the release, and that's the trap.
Yeah, that's right. It's the masochist's jouissance, right? Yeah, to enjoy your suffering and to feel like this proves you are a good Calvinist or, you know, whatever, you're able to serve in hell even without being given the reward of heaven. So, but you're called to serve in heaven and to create heaven, so you have to let go of that. You've played the part to the hilt perfectly. Your reviews are excellent. And now you have a new part to play.
Okay.
All right. Anyone else? Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'll read the one that's called Gratitude, because this is how I feel about these poems.
What number is that?
That is number 327. Uh-huh. Gratitude is to see a thorn and to consider it a rose, to see a fragment and be mindful of the whole.
Beautiful. Yeah. Say more about why that one grabbed you.
Because I feel that this has been and continues to be my transformation, where the ego could always see the shadow, and that was its reality, and that that has shifted, and is shifting, and so. I feel great gratitude for the power that has allowed this to happen, to to this point?
Well, that gratitude is, of course, God's grace. And that gratitude is the lubricant that gets you out of the hell realm of the shadow. It makes the way easy to travel without friction, and it enables you to go through adversity without losing your faith and your joy and your delight, and to be able to recognize every change as bringing you to a higher level of your own spiritual development, that you could face all of that and not be affected by it and continue to feel the gratitude of God's guidance via karma and via shakti to reach the goal of the absolute bliss of what you are. So, thank you. Your gratitude is contagious.
May I also make another comment on what I felt about the poems in general? And I found that it gave a lot of clarity on how the mind, heart, will, soul has to be full for God. Mm-hmm. So that commandment, it was, I think, beautifully detailed. And also in it is about the forgetting, you know, the sweet sorrow. Mm-hmm. So that time, the times where you feel, okay, that's all there is, that's all that matters, everything else, you just flow around. Mm-hmm. And then that moment of forgetfulness is then, as he then says in other poems, just sit and be silent and you'll be returned mm-hmm. to that. So it's been this question I've often had about, how does the mind, heart, will, this entire soul become fully, completely? What's the preparation? What's required? Mm-hmm. And so in these poems, when he describes these moments of forgetfulness, mm-hmm. The sense that it is that forgetfulness, I'm asking because it feels that this is what is happening, that is like that step back that gives you the momentum to go further mm-hmm. and surrender mm-hmm. more and the more completely. Mm-hmm. So there was this these very deep questions that I've been living and am living, that he sees from all these different perspectives. Mm-hmm. And it is a beautiful help almost at every level of the journey. Mm-hmm. It encompasses the entire journey.
Yes.
Yeah.
Beautiful. I'm not sure you had a question in there. But what I'll say is, to what I felt you were asking in part of how to get there, there has to be emptiness before there's fullness, right? You have to go through the emptying of the mind of all its chatter and all of the egoic thought patterns and emotional reactivity, etc. And that has to be completely dissolved and not wanted anymore. One has to want to be no one, nobody, son of nobody, right? And then that emptiness is filled with the presence of God, if there is love and gratitude, and one wants only that, to know oneself, one's real, true nature, and want nothing from the world, then one is filled with the bliss of realization. So this is the blessing of having a traumatized childhood, you know, because you learn very early you don't want anything to do with this world, and love is toxic and false, and there's no goodness in the world, and you can't trust people, and, you know, you become very cynical But it makes you then realize that your own ego is a part of that mess, and you want to be cleansed of having any trace of connection to a hell realm. And that means you can't have any traits of a demon in your own being, or anything that is attracted to the dark side, so that you are free from being trapped by your own proclivities. So, thank you. Beautiful insights. Okay, Parvati.
Thank you, Shunya. It's been, I'm not sure what the word is. It's been really nice to read this book. There's a lot of poems that, kind of hit the heart. There was one you read tonight that didn't stand out so much when I read it, but your explanation of it did, with the story... the sheikh or whatever, went to get the old man, brought the old man in. The old man tells the story of the having lost or a child born, and then loses the child. And then he feels they shed a few tears. There's this compassion. And then your explanation was when the heart feels contracted and all of it, I guess I relate. It's in feeling compassion for the other that you can read that releases, but it felt to me in that moment like mercy, which has come up a few times. So, I feel like part of the contraction that I felt growing up is not having compassion and not having mercy. And so, I'm wondering if you can just help explain or talk more about what is mercy versus compassion. And because there feels like there already is so much pain and suffering, right? And so what is it that's happening in compassion and mercy and feeling that same, that pain in a different way?
Well, mercy is one of the applications of compassion. You feel merciful, meaning you feel forgiving toward those who didn't have compassion or love or treat you very well, and who were themselves unable to express the divine nature or see it in you. So your mercy is forgiveness and letting go of any taint of anger or of feeling traumatized, of feeling hurt, wounded, or insulted, or identified with the oppressor that you took in order to be one up rather than one down the next time you are in a conflict with someone. So mercy is also letting go of any internal aggression or defensiveness. So you have to live with an open heart.
But it's almost like then what's happening in the moment of feeling that towards another is, yes, like having mercy on my own feeling of anger about it. Right? Like, then is it really mercy towards the other? I guess that's where the whole thing just sort of dissolves.
There is no other, you see. They're just your mirrors. So if you had an experience with others who mistreated you, you have to recognize that you dreamed them. They're part of an internal conflict that had to get externalized in order for you to be able to forgive that part and then accept it again as part of your own self, as your own shadow. And now you could become whole instead of split. Because as long as you are split internally, you'll be split from others in conflicting situations, and never be in harmony and equanimity and wholeness. So we can only create real community if we overcome our split minds and our tendency to project our shadow on the other. Otherwise, there can never be love for the other. And there will always be distrust and fear and a sense of alienation. So the mercy has to be complete in our recognition that there is nothing to fear and nothing to hate. But thank you for that. I think it was a very important point that you raised, that we are all, in a sense, not just you, all of us carrying some trace of that kind of mistreatment or emotional abandonment or emotional stultifying over-closeness and generational transgression, or any of the other ways in which we were not seen for who we really are in childhood, and whatever trace of a sense of anger still or lack of forgiveness remains, will recreate those traumas in your life now, but you'll find yourself being the oppressor and being at the same time stuck in situations in which you will be insulted again and not feel mercy from the other, because you are externalizing that lack of mercy for yourself. So it's very important to have a harmonious life and a life in which there is honor and respect, and you're able to plant yourself and grow deep roots in your life so that you can grow very tall. And those who are not willing to make a commitment to their life in a particular context in which they can grow and develop and dig those roots will never be able to develop into tall trees, and the tree of life will remain stunted. So it's a very important point. Anyway, did people enjoy these poems and find them valuable? I hope so. If so, then we'll probably have one more shot at Sheikh Attar's wisdom before we go on to our next reading. By the way, in the video we saw, Hakim mentioned a play by Ibsen that was way too long, like 8 hours long, to be able to perform. And I haven't found any video of it, but we did find the script online. And so I'm going to assign that for our next book group. And Swati's going to send out the text. And you can get it printed if you want. But we'll read that next. The Emperor and Galilean is the name. And from what I've read of it already, I think it is worth it, not just for to understand that very deep Zen koan of Pan and Logos and Logos and Pan, and what that really implies in terms of the relationship of Apollo and Dionysus, but also ego and self. And so I think that it will be an important stepping stone in our understanding of spiritual maturation. So I look forward to discussing that with you as well, and then we'll probably go back to more Mahayana sutras and go deep into the inconceivability of the Buddha mind. Thank you all for your willingness to become the realized beloveds who are manifestations of the one beloved. Namaste.